thank you for your attention at this late stage of the day. I'll skip that slide. So here's an outline of what I'm going to do. I have two parts. The first part, the main conclusion, will be the subjectivity of experience is not in conflict with the objectivity of science, which I think we've already heard. Well, Max said that as much, I think, explicitly. We've heard some other people agree with this. I'm glad there's some agreement here about that. But I'll say a little bit in, so I'll make some philosophical remarks in part one, but then in part two, try to get more specific about how one might go about exploiting the subjectivity of the theorist or the scientist in order to solve some methodological problems in consciousness studies. So it turns out that subjectivity of scientists is not the problem, it's the solution, or it's not a bug, it's a feature. So that's the overall strategy. So first, part one, why might you think we can't have a science of consciousness? Some people think that, for instance, the subjectivity of experience is in conflict with the objectivity of science, so that's why there's some problem with the science of consciousness. So now an overview of this part. For instance, Thomas Nagel has said, I'm going to mention three philosophers on this slide, but I'm not saying that these philosophers came to the conclusion that a science of experience is impossible, but their ideas have been used by people to make that conclusion. So Thomas Nagel, in The View from Nowhere, thought, and in, for instance, What It's Like to Be a Bat, talked about the incompatibility of the subjectivity of experience and the objectivity required for scientific investigation. And this is also, I think, what Searle's getting at when he talks about how science normally proceeds by carving off the subjective aspects of a phenomenon, leaving only the objective aspects. And by doing so, we can give an account of the objective. But that leaves a problem when what you want to study is the subjectivity itself. You can't carve off the subjectivity of the subjective, or there's nothing left. So he confronted science with a problem for understanding consciousness because of its subjectivity. So Nagel's point is that to do science requires an objective, well, actually, this is just the overview, so I'll get into that. And then after going and mentioning Thomas Nagel's argument, I'll also relate it to Frank Jackson's argument, the knowledge argument, Mary, the neuroscientist who's never seen color. So the conclusion of this first part will be that these arguments only seem to work if you make some particular assumptions about what science is like and what objectivity is. And in particular, it requires you to assume that objectivity is the view from nowhere. And it also requires you to assume that science is a disembodied, non-experiential, non-activity. I mean, it's not an activity. Instead, it's something like a set of linguistic statements or propositions. And if you make those assumptions, then you can see where these people are coming from. You can see why Nagel thinks what he thinks, or you can see why Jackson thought what he thought. He doesn't buy the Mary argument anymore, but why Jackson fans think the way they do. And I think those views of science are not plausible. And I can't really argue that here. I think that a lot of you probably agree. But what I want to do is just show that there's an alternative way of conceiving of what science is about that will point the way towards how you can not run into the problems that Nagel and Jackson talk about, and in particular, allow you to solve problems that have been thought to be in the way of a science of consciousness. And I've talked about the Nagel and Jackson stuff, definitely the Nagel stuff, in a paper I have the reference at the end of the talk. So Nagel's argument in brief is something like this. Consciousness is a subjective phenomenon, that is, consciousness is accessible only from a particular point of view, yet scientific accounts should be objective, and by objective, what we mean is accessible from no point of view. They don't involve a perspective on the world that's supposed to be revealing the world as it is, or it's a God's eye view. So if it is from a point of view, it's from the point of view, and it's not meant to be any human point of view. That is, it's meant to contain no subjectivity. So we have a conflict here. How could you, if you ever do manage to adopt this objective point of view, it looks like there's no room in taking that dispassionate, non-perspectival perspective, if that makes any sense, towards your subject matter and also recognizing the existence of perspectives. There seems to be some conflict there. I'm actually not sure that even this argument works, but fortunately we don't have to assess the details of this argument because it's based on, I think, a faulty premise that objectivity is this God's eye point of view or God's eye view or no point of view. So I think we should reject the aim of science as being the achievement of the view from nowhere. Yes, science should strive to be objective, and as Max pointed out, and I think Russ agreed and others agreed, there are these dimensions along which science can be evaluated and should be evaluated, and there are norms to be applied to science, but the one norm that shouldn't be held up against science is the degree to which it achieves God's eye view. You're not striving for this perspectiveless perspective, again, whatever that means. So what are we striving for then? I don't think objectivity is a meaningless term in science. What are we striving for? And you can say intersubjectivity, and that's useful, but I want to say a little bit more. And I found it useful to use some ideas that I got from Brian Cantwell Smith, who incidentally was my person I put down as being wise, but that's independently of his, it's not entirely independent of his philosophical insight, but he's also wise on a personal level too, I think. Anyway, so instead of a view from nowhere, maybe we could see objectivity as a view from anywhere. What does that mean? Well, objectivity is an ability, it's a skill. It's the ability to negotiate context-bound, limited perspectives in an epistemically virtuous way, in a way that reveals the reality of the subject that you're trying to understand. So there's an analogy here that might help. I'm going to modify Brian Cantwell Smith's analogy because I think it can be improved upon. So his analogy is of an acrobat with a torch. It's not an inactive torch, but maybe it is. It's a torch on a stage. So the acrobat is jumping around on the stage. But I'm going to modify this. I haven't given you the full analogy, but I'll give you a modification of the analogy. Suppose there's a butterfly floating around on the stage, and the acrobat wants to keep the light shining on the butterfly. So this analogy is that I'm trying to set up is that the butterfly is the phenomenon that we want to understand. We want to reveal this part of reality. Now, as the butterfly moves around, the acrobat will have to move his or her hand around in order to be able to continue. And the reason why it's called this an acrobat is because the person doing this might have to do quite amazing contortions in order to keep up with the butterfly and continue to reveal the butterfly. Or imagine we can make it harder for the acrobat. Imagine there's a some kind of conveyor belt on the stage, and the acrobat is moving on this conveyor belt, but still wants to keep the butterfly lit up, so the acrobat's going to have to continue jump around and dance and do all kinds of backflips in order to keep the, given how the acrobat is moving around on the stage, and given how the butterfly is moving, to keep that continued intentional link, or link of understanding, or revealing, or bringing forth, the acrobat's going to have to do a lot of acrobatics to do that. So that dance is really what it is to be objective, to be able to know how you need to change and how your particular situation requires you to be oriented in a particular way in order to maintain this common link towards this subject matter. That is what it is to be objective. It isn't the acrobat finding one place on the stage and one orientation of the torch that will reveal the butterfly. That would only be revealing one aspect of the butterfly in one particular situation. But being able to, no matter who might come along and push the acrobat, or who might come along and blow on the butterfly and make it move away in a way that was unexpected, no matter what perturbations are given, if you can maintain that link, then that's a kind of epistemic virtuosity that I would call objectivity. So, seen that way, I think it should be clear that there's no incompatibility between your own subjectivity, your own personal context-bound point of view, and being objective, as long as you can move between your context-bound points of view and realize the consequences for that phenomenon as something independent of yourself. if you don't do that, imagine somebody trying to track an airplane in the air, or just keeping their finger pointed in one direction and not moving along with the air. If they don't change, if they just remain constant in their perspective, and then they won't be able to track the objective phenomenon. But if they alter themselves in a way that respects the phenomenon in the right way, then their subjective egocentric positions can be revealing an objective aspect of the world. So I think this is compatible with, and is in a similar spirit as to Max's comments yesterday about how we can have objectivity in science even if we're dealing with the subjective, that this is a pseudo problem as a result of philosophical thinking or insufficient philosophical thinking. In a similar vein, I think another argument can be dispensed with as being a false problem for consciousness studies and the role of the subjective in an objective science. Just to recap in three bullet points, Jackson's knowledge argument, apologies for those who haven't heard it before, this probably won't give you the gist of the argument, but just as a reminder for those who do know it. So if you suppose that there's a color scientist who actually has never seen any color, but she does have, by hypothesis, all the information that the physical sciences can deliver about color. That is, she's read all the books, for instance, and studied all the experiments that other scientists have done about color. The question we can ask is, when we eventually allow her to see color, for instance, see red for the first time, does she gain any knowledge? Does she now know something that she didn't know before? Most people's intuitions, and this is what Frank Jackson's playing on, are that, yes, she does now know something she didn't know before. She knows what it's like to see red. And he goes, see, the scientists don't have all the knowledge about color. She had, by hypothesis, all the knowledge that science could give you about color, and yet she lacked some knowledge about color. So therefore, there's some knowledge that physical scientists can't deliver, knowledge about what it's like to see red. And that was his conclusion. Now we can see that if on this, the way I think that this thought experiment misleads us is that he assumes at the outset that science is, for instance, some set of propositions that can be written down in red independently of experience. So the hypothesis for me that Mary can have all the knowledge... So the mistake is that Jackson makes is to assume that Mary can both have all the knowledge that science delivers or contains about what is about color, and yet that she's also not seen red. Because for somebody who takes, even drawing on the previous point about Nagel, if you take the goal of science to be a virtuous negotiation of your own subjective views, then a lot of science deals with having subjective understanding of color and just being able to relate that to other subjective understandings, like subjective understandings of this meter reading or subjective understandings of this particular knowledge of the nervous system. So it's a contradiction. Jackson's premise, his thought experiment, is contradictory. He says, suppose she has all the knowledge that science can deliver about color, but she's never seen color. I'd say, well, that's impossible, because knowing what it's like to see color is part of doing color science. Sure, there is room in doing color science for individuals who have never seen color or could never see color. I'm not saying blind people can't contribute to color science. Of course they can. But that those people who do not have the capacity to see color don't therefore have all the information that science as a whole does have about color. And certainly there are color scientists who do know what it's like to see red. And if there weren't any scientists who didn't know what it's like to see any colors at all, then there wouldn't be any color science. We wouldn't know that there's anything to explain. So scientific understanding is an embodied experiential activity. It's not just a set of propositions or linguistic statements that one can read. One can become a good scientist, clearly, becoming a good scientist does require you to do a lot of reading. I'm not saying there isn't a role for text in doing science, but it also requires you to be an experiencer, especially a science of experience requires you to be able to even know what phenomenon is to be explained requires you to be an experiencer. So it's a mistake to think that science should somehow aspire to provide explanations that will work for anybody, regardless of their context or history or abilities or experience. I think explanations are contextual in that they will work for certain people with certain knowledge and skills and experience, and they won't work for others. So you have to make some assumptions about what kind of audience your explanation is for. And if you don't meet the conditions for that are assumed in that audience, then you won't be able to, that explanation won't work for you. So to think that science should somehow be able to come up with an explanation that doesn't exploit the experiences of the subject that's hearing the explanation in order to count as an explanation for them, I think is a mistake. It should be clear what I think about Mary. Matter of fact, I've gone over part of this slide already. She may have all the physical information, but she really, in some sense, but really she doesn't meet Jackson's condition of knowing everything that science knows about vision. For instance, she doesn't know what red looks like. So the fact that she does learn something doesn't indicate that there was something that science doesn't have or doesn't contain about red or about color. And I already said that point, and I already said that. Now, an aside here that I've already alluded to is about the role of the individual versus the community in science. This relates to maybe to some of the things Steve was talking about before. Critics of scientific accounts of consciousness typically assume that scientists are individuals, and scientists are individuals, but they're individuals within a community. And so critics will often say things like, of this form, if an individual cannot achieve X, then science cannot achieve X. But it might also be the case that even if there are individuals who cannot achieve a certain type of understanding, it might be that as a whole, a community as a whole, we can achieve an understanding of a phenomenon, even though no one individual can do that. And I think that becomes more and more clear as we get into more and more complex theories. So there definitely is a social division of epistemic labor, and might get to the point where no one person can know everything, can really understand a phenomenon at all, but together we do understand a phenomenon. Right, so what's the upshot of part one? Well, let's put the scientist in the picture. A science of human cognition in general should apply to the cognition of cognitive scientists in particular. If we're really understanding the nature of mentality for humanity in general, then it should also apply to, in particular, cognitists and people doing consciousness studies. So if cognitive scientists write that cognition is, say, essentially a situated, embodied activity carried out by experiencing agents, then doing cognitive science or a science of consciousness should be as well. So it shouldn't be a surprise that science exploits the subjective, that science is an activity, that science is embodied, because all the other cognition we do is as well. So the part two is going to be looking at how, just one way that this might affect how we actually do science. What methodological forms might a science of consciousness take that exploit this principle? I think maybe it's on another slide. I wanted to connect this with this issue that we were talking about just before I started my lecture, and that came up when Tom was introducing the inactive torch the first night. I think that if you follow the lines I'm suggesting, that you end up with a method that's not just first personal in that it involves what it is like for a subject. It's, for instance, this is, you know, it's important to consider first personal methods in this sense, that we don't just measure the external behavior of a subject, say the reaction times, but also take seriously their reports about what their experience is like. And you could call those first personal. We were having a little discussion about the terminology there. But whatever you call that, I think Tom is right to, and I join with him in this, in considering methods that are radically first personal in that they involve what it is like for the theorist or scientist as well. So not only are we trying to really account for the inner experience, what it's like for the subject, but we're going to do that by exploiting and using the experience, the first personal aspect of the scientist or theorist's experience itself.
Can I just make a very quick comment? The subjects, you know, I mean, the bound, you know, given the earlier point about, you know, like the distributed nature of scientific knowledge, the subject, the boundary between the subject and the scientist, you know, is very fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And you might take a subject as to some extent being from a scientist.
That's right.
More about that later.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so now into part two. So I'm going to give an example of how we might use scientist experiences to do things that we thought were, say, philosophically impossible, because we had a different notion of what science would have to look like, and we were tying both hands behind our backs. Okay, so rewind. This is should. Just to give some context for those of you who were here in 2006 and for those of you who weren't. So I'm just going to mention some connections between what I'm saying now and what I said 2 years ago, and so that will highlight the differences. So before I was, I gave some reasons to believe that, well, just said that a science of consciousness needs a way to precisely specify the experiences, particular experiences, not just experience in general, but the experience that Russ is having right now after the, and the way to do, one way to do that is to specify the content of those experiences, and it's would be a good idea if you want to have a science of these experiential states, then you should be able to specify the content in a communicable way, that is a way that allows the social aspect of science to continue. Michelle mentioned that Chalmers mentions that we need a first-person formalism. Maybe that's what Chalmers was getting at when he was talking about that. I don't personally. I think formalism is a very misleading word. If you think that what you need is formalism, then you might think of something as some kind of linguistic entity that's going to help solve this problem. As you'll see in a second, I think that linguistic entities are not the way to go. We've already got those, and they're useful, definitely. I'm not saying they aren't useful, but there's a lot of conscious experience that's left out when you focus entirely on lingua form means of specification. And I was having a conversation with Roz over lunch, and she made me see, or helped me see, that communicability is good to strive for, but there's also a use, perhaps, for non-communicable means of specifying experiences just for the purpose of your own investigation. So even if you can't use this means of specifying an experience to anybody else, it's private in some non-philosophically loaded sense, it's idiosyncratic to you, it still might be useful for you, even if it's, you know, the scribblings you make in a notebook or something. Nobody else can make head or tail of them, but it still might be useful when you look back later and say, oh yeah, that's what I was thinking. So it's a much more glorified aide-mémoire here. So I'm not saying you only communicable alternatives or ways of specifying experience are of use, but I am also interested in ones that are communicable. The problem is that the standard way of specifying the content of mental states is to use language, is to find that clauses. In the case of non-experiential states, say when we want to ask somebody, when we want to specify the belief content of somebody, what, you know, what is it that they believe right now? Well, they believe the computer's on the table, or they believe that today is Tuesday, or something like that. We come up with a bit of language that has the very same content as the content of the belief that we want to specify. And that might work for certain mental states. It does work for certain mental states. It might even work for some experiential states. Certainly, a lot of our experiential states could very well have propositional content to them. But it does seem to me, and I don't have time to argue this, maybe I'd be preaching to the choir anyway, that there are a lot of aspects of experience that cannot be captured this way, that don't have easily specifiable content that's easily specifiable linguistically. So I'm looking for a means of specification that will work for these aspects of experience that aren't capturable conceptually or linguistically. Rewind. Okay, that's fine.
You want to know what you're being committed to.
Well, the reason why I put down Claire's name, is because a lot of the methodologies that are first personal, nevertheless, how else would we do it is the problem. How else do I find out what the content of a subject's experience is other than by asking them? And I don't mean to demean that at all. It's a very good way. It's a prime way to know what someone's experience is to ask them. But we have lots of caveats about when to listen to them, when not to listen to them. But I'm also interested in the aspects of the experience that aren't easily so captured that way. So this isn't a criticism. It's just let a thousand flowers bloom kind of thing. So an idea is to look for techniques that show, don't tell. So you don't try to come up with a statement of what the content of the experience is, but somehow it evokes in the theorist an understanding of what the experience being specified is, but not through the mediation directly of language. And that's what was my point from 2 years ago. And so I looked at the natural place to look is to the arts. There's at least one strain of the arts that for millennia has been trying to solve this problem. How can I communicate this exquisite experience I'm having, this feeling I'm having, to other people? I really want you to know what I'm feeling right now. And I could try to do it linguistically, and let's take prose, for instance. That works. But then what about more poetic uses of language, figurative uses of language? That works too. That works even better sometimes. Sometimes poetry is the only way I can really communicate to you. But what about non-linguistic methods? Oh, right, I'll paint, I'll write a symphony, I will, I'll hug you, I'll do, you know. There are all kinds of ways of letting you know how I feel and what I'm experiencing right now that aren't linguistic. And the arts has some really good techniques that they've been developing for millennia about how to do that. That was the topic of my talk 2 years ago. But now let's go, what's different about today? Well, today I'm not going to be focusing so much on how the arts can contribute, although you might see there are ways in which the method I'm using would benefit from somebody who knows something about graphic arts. But I will be pursuing an alternative means of specifying experiential states. So an obvious idea is that you should use non-linguistic, non-symbolic means of specifying. Maybe that will allow us to get at these contents of experience that don't have linguistic conceptual shape to them. So for instance, for the case of visual experiences, maybe we could use images. So what does it look like to me right now? Well, I could say, well, it looks like to me that there's a red patch over there, and then another black patch over there, and there's the people in the room. I could make a really long list of all the propositions that might be supported by this experience, but that's got all kinds of problems because, you know, in some sense I'd like to think a child can have an experience similar to the one I'm having right now, but they don't have all those concepts of maybe armchair and people and, you know, paintings and things like that. So it would be nice to just show you a picture. Well, this is what it looks like to me right now, and just give you a picture. And there I'm not committing myself to what concepts are in play. And I'm not saying this captures all of my visual experience. There's lots of my visual experience that is linguistically and conceptually structured, but at least part of my visual experience has this more primitive, just having to do with patterns of light and texture. And, I'm going to be focusing on the case of visual experience and images, but again, in a conversation with Roz, an important question to ask is, can we generalize this to other modalities? We always focus on, many people focus on the visual case, and this approach would benefit from considering how it could be extended to other modalities. On this approach, this very simplistic approach, the experiential content specified is just the content of experience that the theorist has when the theorist looks at this image. So I'm one scientist trying to tell you another scientist about the experience that some infant had in this supposed scientific explanation of, you know, scientific situation, experimental situation that constitutes our science of consciousness. And so I give you a picture in order to give you an idea of what the infant's experience was at that time. Well, that's pretty naive. You can't just take a picture of the scene to even capture this subset of experience, even if we just limit it to the visual experience and we consider snapshots of experience to make sense. and we're just interested in the non-conceptual aspects of visual experience, that isn't even going to work because it's too literalistic. I mean, it really ignores the whole point of science of consciousness, the subjectivity involved, not just the subjectivity of the subject we're trying to characterize, say the infant, this hypothetical infant, maybe Ethan from the video, but also the subjectivity of the theorist. That is, the theorist will have all kinds of experiential aspects that he or she will bring to seeing that picture that might be irrelevant, obviously, to the child. So how does, I mean, phenomenologists have studied this, how do you bracket out all that extra baggage that you're bringing to it? But maybe we can come up with better specifications that don't require you to bracket so much. Another naive idea is, well, we'll just take the raw output from the eyes. We'll take the signal. Somehow the experiences that I'm having right now depend on, the visual experiences depend on the signals that the eyes are sending to the brain. It isn't a simple relationship, but it depends on it somehow. So why don't I just look at the raw output of the eyes? And that might seem odd, but in a minute you'll see that I'm constructing robotic models of perceptual experience. So that's not such a science fiction idea for me. I could take my robotic model and just look at the output of the robot's camera and then say, oh, that's what its experience is right now, and have a picture of it, and I say, oh, right, now I understand what the, you know, robot doesn't have experience, but its modeling experience, say, now I can understand what the content of the modeled experience is. It's just the output of the robot's camera at any time. And in most, all papers, say, in machine consciousness, where people are building simulations of robots that are model experience, or they build real robots that are supposedly modeling experience, they typically do that. They say, here's what the robot sees at time t, and they'll show you the output of the camera. And I think that's, if that's true, then that means it's a very impoverished model of experience, because our experience isn't like that. We contribute as much to our subjectivity and our current state and our knowledge and all kinds of perceptual processes contribute as much to the content of our experience as the input from the eye does. In fact, the model that I favor sees most of our visual experience at any one time as a kind of, you could think of it as a kind of, other people have used this term, controlled hallucination. That, the information that's part of the information that's coming into my eye right now plays a big role in determining the content of my experience, visual experience right now, but most of the rest of it is expectations drawn from my previous scanning of the scene. So right now, there's a lot of stuff here that I'm contributing to the experience that isn't based on the information coming into my eye. And if you take that view, it explains a lot of things like filling in and change blindness and a lot of illusions, etc. So that's the view that I take, and that's why I'm not impressed by this idea of just using the raw output of the
eye. Well, actually, you have the same problem, actually. If you look at the fly research, so this is what the fly sees. They actually have like a grid-like camera view. Of course the fly is not going to have grid
This is the kind of issue I want to get into, and I don't want to laugh at, I mean, at least they're trying, and so I don't want to laugh at that, and I'm probably making similar mistakes in what I do, but I want to at least start saying, how can we do better? How can we actually try to, what is this, you know, to throw terms around, what is this process of interpretation or verstehen or whatever that's going on here? How can we bracket certain parts of the specification, like say, well, don't pay attention to the line, or interpret the line as something else. To you, it means there's a black thing in your environment, but now, since it's a specification of the fly's experience, don't interpret it as the fly sees a black line there, interpret it as something else. So what can we do with this problem? So, for instance, the output of our eye has blind spots, has gaps in it, yet we don't see these gaps. The gaps are not part of our experience. And, for instance, I tend to trust the folk on this issue. Some theorists, in a very theory-driven, for very ideological reasons, want to deny that, say, the visual field is colored, seems to be colored to the periphery, it seems to be detailed, seems to be stable. They know what the neurophysiological facts are, and they want so much to have a simple relationship between the phenomenology and the neurophysiology that they just deny what our reports about our phenomenology. They say, actually, no, that isn't how it seems to us. The world doesn't seem to be colored to the periphery. And that's how they try to, say, account for change blindness. And but I think we should take our reports at face value and try to explain why we tend to say these things, at least. And the way I the theory that I favor is that the reason why we tend to give these reports is because our experience really is like that. And what does that mean? Well, it means that we're contributing a lot to our experience. We're not getting colored information about the periphery from the through the eye right now, so we must be contributing the color based on previous experience.
I don't think you have to go to the extreme examples. A lot of beats where people's eyes are open, they're not paying any attention at all. They will deny under very careful questioning that they're even seeing the contact, including while they're driving. And
sure. Okay, no, I would say on some of the beeps too, I was saying there's no visual experience right now, that that's, or it's only, so it's very, very transient. But I'm saying when you are actually having a visual experience and you say, yes, I'm having a visual experience now, if subjects report that their visual field is colored to the periphery, I'm taking them on their word at that. I'm saying, okay, that's something we need to account for, why it seems to them as if there's color here, even though their eye is not giving them color from that part of the world. So that's what I think we need to account for. And some people say, oh, well, it means that they're not really having an experience like that. I prefer to say they are really having an experience like that, and I can explain why they're having an experience like that, even though they're not getting the information.
Well, I do have something to say about that, but I don't want to take that.
Okay, yeah, let's see, I'm on minute 39 now. So let's have an alternative to this simplistic, naive, literalistic approach. So what I'm going to be doing is still using images, but theory-mediated images. I'll call them depictions. And the image doesn't create an analogous experience in the viewer directly. So it's not like the experience I'm trying to specify, content of the experience I'm trying to specify is the content of the experience you have when you see this image. Not quite. That's a good first start, but it's more sophisticated than that. The idea is that the image allows you to visualize the relevant aspects of the system as determined by some theory, such that you know what aspects that robotic system has or that subject has, and therefore you know what experience they have according to this theory, but you know it in a particular way, which exploits your own experiential capacities. This will make more sense, I think, on the next slide. So this is part of an approach that I call synthetic phenomenology. So let me elaborate this a little bit more. What do I mean by synthetic phenomenology? What are these depictions like? Well, in our approach, we construct a robotic model of some perceptual capacities with the intent of it modeling experience. Not having experience, don't worry, I don't think my robots have experience, but they model aspects of experience. Now, we appeal to what I call a qualitative theory of consciousness. I don't know if this is a good terminology, but I'll explain what the difference is between qualitative and what you might call constitutive quantitative. That quantitative is really bad. Anyway, there are other theories of consciousness that are what people usually talk about when they talk about the hard problem, but this is a qualitative theory of consciousness. It's just a theory that tells you, assuming you already have an experiential subject, which experiential state are they in, given which non-experiential state they're in. Like, given the state of their brain or the state of their environment and body, and given that they're an experiential subject, what experiential state are they in? That kind of theory of consciousness. It doesn't say, how do you get from physical stuff to experiential stuff? It doesn't say, why is it that when you put a brain in the world, you get experiencing going on, whereas when you put a rock in the world, you don't get experiencing going on. It doesn't explain that issue, but it says, well, we already know this is an experiencer here. It's a person. That's not in doubt. Now, why is it that they see red as opposed to blue? And it tries to answer that. Or why is it that they didn't notice the change as opposed to noticing the change? It tries to explain that. So then we appeal to the skill states of the robot that determine, according to the theory, the content of the visual experience that it's modeling. And then, here's where the depiction comes in, you depict these states of the robot in such a way that when a theorist looks at this depiction, the theorist will go, oh, right. I see what states the robot has, what, in our case, expectations the robot has. Just by looking at this picture and knowing how to interpret it, I can understand what expectations the robot has. And because I know the theory as well, I now know what experience that depiction is specifying.
Can I just ask quickly, one question for clarification. I don't think I understand what you mean necessarily by skill states. And then you said expectation, and I have difficulty with that.
You're right. I'm using...
them to mean the same thing. So they're just, I'm going to talk about it a little bit more, but it's just, you can just, it's put in a placeholder there. What is it about the robot that means that it's in a state, that it's modeling a state of experiencing red as opposed to modeling a state of experiencing blue? And some people would say, oh, because it's this neuron's firing in it. Or somebody else would say, because it has this data structure. Or somebody else would say, because it has this sensory motor capacity that it's engaging in, that it's using at this time, right? And the latter one is mine, only it's a bit different from a Regan and noise. It's just an expectation. Because it expects to receive a certain kind of input were it to move its head a particular way, then right now it is experiencing, let's say it expects to receive a blue input if it were to move its head a particular way, then even though it's looking here and not looking there, it sees blue here now. It has an experience of blue here now because it expects that were it to move that way, it would see blue. It would get, it, get a blue input.
At the end, I'm going to ask more about expectations.
Okay, all right.
And also, you must have a specification of how you get from a movement to a blue.
A movement to a blue.
Well, that's what you just said. If I move in a certain way, I expect to see blue.
Uh-huh.
That's
actually
in the sense of the
story. Uh-huh, yeah. What do you mean, how you get from it?
The connection between moving in a certain way and seeing the blue.
Because if there's a blue thing over there, and if I move and I foveate on it, I will get a blue input.
Oh,
if I foveate over here, I won't get a blue input.
Sorry, I thought you were addressing the question of how do you ground an experience of blue as such?
No. But you're right. That, my account doesn't, it presupposes that. Yeah, you're right. That's
because robots are very wise.
I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip this theory. Skip this slide. I've already explained the difference between quantitative and qualitative theories of consciousness. So, okay. So here's what you're more interested in, Susan, in expectations.
I am.
So, this looks a little bit technical, but I'll try to make it more intuitive. I'm interested in part of the non-conceptual content of the visual experience of a subject at a time. So I'm only interested in visual experience, I'm only interested in non-conceptual aspects of visual experience, and I'm only interested in some part of that. Okay. Now, what is, according to this theory, what is this part of experience for a subject at a time? Well, it's the set of all, the set for all the actions that the subject has of a particular sort. In this case, let's consider it to be eye movements, like saccading. For all the saccades I could perform right now, the set of all the expectations I have for what input I would receive were I to make that saccade. So right now, if I'm looking at Michelle, I might have an expectation from my previous, for all kinds of reasons, my previous scanning of the room, my expectations about how rooms are arranged, what people are here. Anyway, all kinds of reasons why I might have expectations, but anyway, the content of my experience is not just the input that I'm getting from this region of space, mainly the Michelle area of the room, but also my experience is all the inputs I would expect to receive were I to move my eyes in all these different ways. And that's why there's a spatial structure to my experience right now, because there's a spatial structure to this set of actions. This isocod brings my eyes down here, this isocod brings my eyes down here, and the expectations I have are, like Max talks about, are actually located in a space structured by those actions. So that's why, that's the theory that I'm using. I'm assuming that it makes sense to talk about expectations, and I'm just saying your experience is the set of your expectations at a particular time, arrayed in the spatially relevant way that the actions are arrayed. So again, these saccades have all this spatial structure to them, so all the expectations about that spatial structure to them.
And are they based on previous?
They can be. They could be. You could imagine. Well, normally they would be. In a good visual subject, that you will have your expectations based on what you last saw there. But we're smart. We know that if we saw, last time we looked over there, we saw a rolling ball.
Yeah.
We're not stupid and think, well, if I look back over there, I'm going to see a rolling ball. No, by the time you look back again, it probably has moved on, and you now expect to see a rolling ball over there, even though you saw it over here before. You know, that kind of. The simplest case, though, is just this static case. Running out of time.
Oh, well. That's too old. Thank you.
So you can model these kinds of expectations in a very simple computational framework. You can put it. You can use a feed-forward neural network, for instance, or you can use. You could, for instance, you could use a. You could even have a neural network learn these expectations. You don't have to give it to them. Just have it learn it, like, and have it generalized from sets of. It moves its eyes in a particular way, and it gets a particular input, and it begins to make. Adjust its weights in such a way that next time it makes a particular eye movement, it will have a better expectation of what the input it receives than it did last time. In a way, actually, that's how I started out doing this kind of thing, using these expectation-based architectures. I didn't call them that at the time, but they were actually the model of the kind of thing Tom was talking about, because it was a robot with a with sonar. And the sonar was it had one sonar, but it had a rotating mirror, in effect, that allowed it to get sonar readings from all around the room continuously. So it's constantly moving. It's an active torch around. And by doing that, I just had a neural network running, always trying to predict what the next sonar reading was going to be from the previous sonar readings and from the past. And so it would build up basically a picture of the world, even though at only any one time it's only getting just one sonar reading. But anyway, that's a side biographical issue. That was a long time ago. So we don't use neural networks in the demonstration I'm going to give you today. Just use a simple symbolic array, a lookup table. Effectively, the model is you expect to see at a location. That is, when I say at a location, I mean when you make a particular eye movement, you expect to see you expect to get as input. The input you most recently got when you had your eyes at that position. So you're just assuming that the agent is assuming the world is static. It's not really. Well, it's not actually assuming the world is static, because if it's wrong, it will update its model. So if previously I had my eyes this way and I saw black, and then I look away and then I move back, I expect to see black there. As a matter of fact, I do see black there. I expect to receive a black input there, and because I expect to see a black input there, I am having an experience of black there. But then when eventually I do saccade there, then my expectations are modified. I now no longer expect to see black there. I now expect to see brown there, because that's just the model. The model says update your expectations to be, expect to see at L, or expect to receive as input at a location the input that one most recently received at that location. Forget about talk about C, that's very confusing. Sorry about that. So if an agent is never foveated on a location, which wouldn't make any sense for most real creatures, but in this robotic simulation you start having never foveated at particular places, then you don't have any expectations. It's undefined. Okay, let's move on. So here's the actual where's my mouse? Come back. Okay, I click on the image and it doesn't play. Oh, there you go. Have a look. Okay, so here's the robot really quite slowly scanning its environment. It's really just a glorified, forget the fact that it's an IBO, it's a dog shape. It's just a glorified closed circuit TV camera at this point. It doesn't do anything robotically interesting other than moving around like that. The goal is to eventually integrate it with other activities like being able to move, but right now it's just, locomote, but right now it's just pivoting. And you should think of that head as being a big eyeball, and there being, the eye really here, the lens is here at the tip of the nose, so it's just one big eye psychoting around. That's how we think of it.
Is that one big eye with the pronoun, or one big...
Oh, sorry, EYE, eyeball. Okay, you don't need to see that. You don't need to see how it explains change blindness, because... Yeah, I know, well, life's too short. So, now how do we... Let's get finally to the depictive specifications of the content of visual experience. So we're supposing this theory is right. Whether or not you like the theory is irrelevant. I'm only using it as an example theory just to give you an idea of how you could depictively specify experience. So it's just a placeholder theory. I actually happen to like it, but that's beside the point. It's not my main point today. I'm not trying to argue for this theory, this expectation-based theory of experience. Instead, I just use it as a way of coming up with depictions that according to the theory, would be good specifications of experience. If the theory is right that the set of expectations that the robot has at a particular time determines the experiential content that it's modeling, then if we display those sets of expectations in the right way, then we will have specified the content. And I could communicate the content I have in mind to you by giving you this visualization of its expectations, and if the theory is right, then you will also be knowing what content it has. Now, what would not be displaying it in the right way? What would be displaying it in the wrong way? Well, if I gave you a list of linguistic statements that referred to the expectations that the robot has at this time, that wouldn't be useful. It wouldn't convey to you the experience the robot is having.
So, as I understand it, are you saying that this is a very intuitive way for conveying something, but in some sense, you know, programmatically, it's still a list, a symbolic list, right?
No, it isn't.
If someone looked at the program code and looked at the lookup table, in some sense, it is exactly that.
That's right. That's why I haven't told you what the specification is. It isn't the program code. That would be a bad way of doing it, too.
So what's the difference?
I haven't shown you yet. I haven't even shown you what the depiction's like yet. So I'm showing you this is not the right way to do it. On the next bullet point, you'll see what I think the right way to do it is. And it's not showing you the code. So instead, the right way to do it is to give you an image that requires you to probe the space, but it's an image that contains the information about the expectation state of the robot, but it does so in a way that requires you to interactively probe the space and use abilities and develop expectations that are isomorphic with the ones that are constituting the experience we're trying to explain. So there's a relation here between your experience that you're having as a theorist and the experience that we're attempting to explain. It isn't identity. I'm not saying when you look at this image, you're having the experience that that is being modeled, but rather you're having an experience that shares important properties with the experience to be specified, and that together with your knowledge of the theory allows you to know which experience is being specified. So what are these depictions? I'm going to show you some, but just a little bit more about what they are. First of all, I don't think that they're not images occurring in the head of the subject or in the head of the robot. They don't occur anywhere. They're theoretical constructs. They're ways of one theorist communicating to another what the experience being specified is. And again, they're the experience corresponding to expected inputs, not the current actual inputs. It's the experience, remember, according to this theory, your experience is not just the information you're receiving through your eyes right now, but your expectations of what inputs you would receive were you to move your eyes this way and that. So they're generated offline by the theorist, or even interactively online. You sample the action space, you feed the actions into your forward model, whether it be a neural network or a lookup table. The output you get is the expected input, and then you arrange these expectations spatially according to the spatial properties of the action that generated them. And the theorist's experience of the depiction plus the interpretation and bracketing instructions that have been given depends on the same saccading and generation of expectations as does the experience we're specifying. Anyway, so let me just one more slide, and then I'll show you some of these depictions. In the depictions, you're going to see the filled-in areas specify, again, what input the robot would expect to receive if it moved its head, so that is looking at that location. And gray areas, which there will be a lot of, do not indicate an expectation to receive gray input. So I'm giving you instructions to say when you see gray, don't interpret it as the robot having an experience of gray there. It just means there's no expectation of any color there at all. And notice that an absence of an expectation is not the expectation of absence. So it's not like the robot's expecting there to be nothing there. It's not like the robot's expecting there to be a gray input if it were to look that way. It just doesn't have any expectations at all.
Which means it hasn't looked that way yet.
For instance, yeah, that's right. And so it's just an artificial aspect of the model, the robot starting from nothing and being purely empiricist and building up from nothing. We don't do that. We have a whole lifetime of
of expectations for what we'll see, and we never move from zero to, well, when we wake up. So alternative architectures, for instance, a generalizing neural network wouldn't have any gray areas. It would always have some expectation for what input it would receive if it were to move its eye in a particular way. It just might be random or rubbish for most of the time if it hasn't had any experience with that, of that part of the world. Okay, so again, the mouse. So here's the raw camera input from the robot over a sequence of times, and you see they're not spatially arranged in any way, and there's no distinction between periphery and foveal area. Here's some simple pre-processing where we've identified a region of the input at any particular time to be the actual foveated information. This will update the robot's sets of expectations for what input it would receive at that particular, if it were to move its eyes a particular way. But notice there's a blind spot, so no expectations are updated in that particular area. Okay. And now, here's an example of how depictions can be built up interactively by having the robot sample the space. So initially, there will be these gray dots here, but remember, that doesn't mean that the robot is expecting to get a gray input if it looks there. It just doesn't have any expectations about what input it would receive if it did look that way. But also notice that as time goes on, what was a blind spot from one vantage point isn't a blind spot from another vantage point. So now there, in general, there aren't any absences of expectations. Well, there was one there, but now there isn't. So now the robot has, this is meant to depict the experience the robot is modeling right now. Even though the robot's looking, say, there right now, it still has, according to this theory, this entire field of experience. And that difference between where you're getting input right now and yet the broad field of your experience contributed by your expectations, as I said earlier, can explain change blindness and filling in and inattentional blindness and things like that.
Are the updates,
same question, I think.
Yeah.
Real time?
Are they based on its circadian, just randomly?
Yeah, random. Oh, well, actually, Joel, who did the programming for this, had different modes. Sometimes, in this case, we just had a random algorithm, but he did apply some kind of simple form of saliency mapping. So when it detected a change, it would direct its attention there and stay there for a while until it got bored, and then it would randomly wander away.
And
so what do I mean by detecting a change? I mean, your expectations for what the input you would receive when you moved your eye there are different from the input you actually got when you moved your eye there. And then there's a more sophisticated notion of, that's actually not really detecting a change. That's just a change in your experience. Detecting a change is when, in the periphery, you outside of the foveal area, you noticed some change. That is, there was a low-level change detector. And then when you reoriented and foveated on that area where you pre-attentionally detected change, you actually did get an input that was different from your expected input. So when those two conditions are met, that is redirection of attention because of pre-attentionally detected change and violation of your expectations by the current input, when both of those conditions are met, then that models the awareness of change phenomenon. And what happens with change blindness is that one of those conditions isn't met, and so even though there is a change in your experience, you didn't detect that by reorienting your attention, and so that's the change blindness.
You do something to suppress the low level.
That's right. So I think I've only just got one or two slides left, so let me just finish. So that's a slide that illustrates detections of change awareness. Actually, that was it. I'm going to skip this slide.
Well done.
And, oh yeah. Finally, sorry, there's a connection. Well, don't want to thank you yet. So, thus, successful specification depends on the experiential states of the scientist-theorist. It's only by virtue of you looking at these depictions and circading across them and building up a set of expectations, basically seeing this whole thing and using those very same abilities that the robot is supposedly using in order to have that experiential state, that you come to understand what abilities the robot has in the right way. You don't understand it by looking at a list of the robot's abilities. You understand what abilities the robot has by using the very same abilities yourself. And so that will hopefully allow you to grasp what experience is being specified. And so I'm exploiting your own subjective ability to do that. And so therefore I'm using your subjectivity to specify experience. It's not an obstacle to doing the science. Actually, it's required. I'm not going to be able to communicate these pre-linguistic, sub-conceptual experiential states unless I exploit your subjectivity. So I think Max is right that intersubjectivity requires subjectivity, and here's a specific way that it requires that. So now, thank you.
Thank you.
I saw Susan's hand first.
I was looking at this. I'm going to ask you a really, really easy question. When you refer to this as synthetic phenomenology, are you synthesizing real phenomenology, or is it an artificial phenomenology?
Right. As it stands now, clearly, I don't think I'm synthesizing actual phenomenological states.
Right.
Rather, what I'm doing is doing a phenomenology by creating artifacts, synthesizing systems. I'm not synthesizing phenomenology. See, I don't think phenomenology means phenomenal states. So synthetic phenomenality is a term that Rob Claus, a colleague of mine, has suggested for what other machine consciousness people are trying to do. They're actually trying to create phenomenal, synthesize phenomenal states in an artifact.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to do that. So I call it synthetic phenomenology, meaning I'm doing phenomenology by helping myself to artifacts that might help me do the phenomenology in addition to using language. I use in formalisms, I use the actual robot. And then I also use your abilities to see its these specifications of its states in a particular way to convey the experience.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll just go down the line. Michelle, yeah.
Okay, I'm very sympathetic, of course, with your definition of science as a view of from anywhere. I like very much the expression and the idea which is behind.
I have to give Brian Catwell Smith the credit for that, though. So
from anywhere, also
anywhere,
anywhere. Oh, okay.
Anywhere. Yeah. It's less ambitious anywhere than anywhere.
I'm not sure. The history of this is a bit confusing. I think when I used to work with him, with Brian Campbell Smith, and I think he said, or maybe Adrian Cousins said, the view from everywhere. And I think I might have been the one. I'm not sure who said the view from anywhere, but I like anywhere better because it's not that I have to be able to adopt all perspectives, but any arbitrary perspective. If I can deal with that, then I have an objective understanding.
So, okay, I accept this idea. I love it. And I also accept the idea that we would not have a science of color if nobody could experience color, even though the contents of this science is very abstract or maybe formal, mathematical, or verbal. Yet, I think there is a sense in which Searle is right when he says the science carves of subjectivity, because we should just think of what would be a science of just correlations between several wavelengths of light and the activation of pigments of the retina and the activation of some part of the occipital cortex. Its contents would be almost identical to our so-called science of color. And so there is a sense in which in the end product of that science, the departure point and the condition for it to be a science of color have been extracted.
I agree with you. But I think the twist is that the science of color so far is pretty much, it is exactly what Searle said. So far, the science of color has pretty much just carved off the subjective and explained the objective bits underlying it. But we want to have a science of color that doesn't just deal with that, but relates those to this what it's like to see.
Yeah.
I have an explanation for that. Right now, we just have a correlation between certain things, and we'd like to know, well, why is it that I see red under these conditions as opposed to blue? And by the way, I didn't answer that. I didn't give an explanation. My expectation-based theory, as Max seemed to be realizing, doesn't explain why redness, it doesn't explain red versus blue per se. It just says, assume you've got so many different types of, we could call it color experience, but it's really only just visual experience. and they can be spatially arrayed. Then this will explain why you have that set over there as opposed to that set. But it does explain why that one's blue and that one's red. It just has labels for them. And that would require another an activist account, and I know O'Regan is working on a purely an activist account of why it seems blue has a different pattern of sensory motor contingencies than red does, and it blue changes in subtle ways differently than red does, and so he attempts to give an activist account of the difference between red and blue. And so I would just, since I find that way of thinking so fruitful in my other work, I would just try to adopt the theory that they produce wholesale and say, okay, now I'm gonna implement that part of their theory too. And but anyway, sorry to.
Can I interrupt for just a moment and say we want to leave time for the BEEP report. It's 5:35. If people are willing to just go into dinner at 6, which is not a problem in practical terms, then we could go on for another 10 minutes. We still have plenty of time for the BEEP report. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Max.
Ron, the first part of your talk was very much focused on finding an alternative to verbally based phenomenology of consciousness. And so I assume that the second part of your talk was intended to produce an alternative.
Yeah, it was.
No, it's kind of important because, well, you can tell me, it disabused me of this, but that was my impression. And I think you actually did say at various points that your expectation-based depiction, if you like, that you were building into your robot, would at least be a contender for such a...
That's right, yeah.
Now, my problem with it, unless I've misunderstood what you're saying, is this. You've, I think, already accepted, in fact, been kind of explicit, that the only way that you'd be able to read the actual expectation-based movements of the robot, give it an interpretation in terms of what it might be seeing, is if you'd already seen yourself, because otherwise there'd be no way of mapping the sequences, the cards in the robot.
Oh no, you don't have to see the scene, but you have to see the depiction of the scene.
Well, this is my question to you. But it seems to me that you could get a particular set of movements, whatever they were, but that would have an infinitely large number of interpretations, because whenever you place the robot in a different scene, it could have succumbed around that scene.
Oh, you're right. That's fine. Matter of fact, that's what we want.
Long description from the expectation-based depiction.
But that's what we want, actually. You're right. It does have a feature, but I want it to have that feature. Why? Because my experience, visual experience right now, I'm not talking about the conceptual experience, which is that Max is in front of me and that is, involves concepts of individuals. I just mean the kind of pattern of colors and textures and that. The content of that experience can be filled in, could be correct under a wide range of situations. It could be that they're all false fronts of chairs that aren't really chairs there, but they did things just like chairs but have the same appearance as chairs did. That would also be consistent with my current low-level visual experience. Not consistent with my conceptual experience, because my conceptual experience is that there are real chairs there. And then if there weren't real chairs there, the experience would be wrong. But the low-level could be filled in many, many different ways. And that's actually trivially true. You think about variables that don't make a visual difference. So it could be that, the stuff that doesn't have any impact on color, you could imagine, this atom being there versus that atom being there. There are all kinds of low-level differences that would be compatible with my visual experience right now. So I'm glad that the depiction that the experience that you get could also be realized in this infinite number of ways, because that's exactly the experience that I'm trying to model, the one that could be realized in an infinite number of ways. So I'm not worried about it not being unique to a particular, requiring the world to be this exact way. So I'm just sorry to disappoint you, but I see that as a feature, not a bug. But I thought your question was going to go another way. I thought you said
you think you're producing a non-linguistic means of specification, but it is linguistic. Or did I mishear you?
No, that wasn't my question.
Oh, good, good, okay. I was getting worried.
I really wanted to know what one got, what the cache value was of the actual depiction.
That's something I haven't talked about. One said really very quickly about that. I had a bit on a slide that I went past quickly, which says, yeah, we need to evaluate these depictions. What's the cache value? So can we use these depictions to actually communicate between theorists and basically use this expectation-based theory of experience to make predictions about how subjects will respond to questions, for instance, about their experience? I think since it can be used to model change blindness, we can use these depictions to say, oh, right, given that their experience is like that, as depicted like that, I'm going to predict that they won't say that they saw a change in their visual field because we didn't get the attentional redirection and the noticing of, all the things that I said had to be in place. So I think that's like one concrete way that you could use these depictions as a way of communicating to other theorists and making predictions and getting cache value out of them. But you're right that I haven't evaluated different depictions and said, okay, how much does this really tell you about the experiential state of the subject over a verbal description of the experiential state, which are very useful. So I need to find situations where the fine-grained detail is important to making a prediction about the subject's behavior that a verbal glossing wouldn't allow me to make.
Just following on to that, then you'll have a difficulty, I guess, of finding a criteria of success as well, to successfully represent that state, because if you can't say what it is about the scene, only conceptualize what it was that needed to be, so then...
Oh, no, you can have behavioral, you should, and verbal reports. So the great thing about the change blindness example is it isn't just a low-level behavior that I'd be trying to predict. It's actually, I'm trying to predict verbal reports. So in our case, we have the dog bark. When those two conditions are met, when its attention has been redirected to some place because of a pre-attentional motion detection or change detection, and it also happens that its expectations are violated, that it had an expectation to receive a blue input there, but now it doesn't, then the dog barks. The two conditions for being aware of change are met. But when the dog just happens to move to a place where its expectations are violated, but it wasn't moved there because of a pre-attentional redirection of attention, it doesn't bark.
That's linguistic.
Right, it's linguistic. So I'm trying to say not only can we match it up to subjects' nonverbal behavior, but we can also explain why they give the reports. Of course we can't. I don't have a... This is a toy example. Oh, you've got all these funny pictures up again. This is a toy model of what's that?
We can see where you've been.
Yeah, that's it. It's a toy. It's only meant to be a demonstration of concept. I'm not claiming to be a vision scientist. I'm not claiming to have provided an explanation of of change blindness that meets all that would satisfy vision scientists. But it's meant to give an idea of how you could depict. Specify experiences in a way that can play a role in real science, that is, real vision science or change blindness explanations or something like that. I hope that's good enough.
Perhaps you told that already, but how would that look if you transfer this in working with a real person? How would that, how could that help the first person non-synthetic or, I don't know, first person researcher?
Right, well, first of all, I do think... it already is first personal in this radical way, but yeah. What about real subjects? That's a broad question that has to do with how we use models. You're right. It's very far away because I think we first need to get clear on the methodologies and concepts that we will eventually apply to real cases by using artificial cases. So I'm an AI kind of person. I think. The reason why we got to build airplanes that eventually flew wasn't because we copied slavishly birds and their structure. We created artificial flying things that didn't have much similarity with birds, but because we created these things, we could understand the abstract principles of flight, and then we could apply them to understand how birds fly. So that's what I think is going to happen with consciousness. When we were at the Towards the Science of Consciousness in Budapest last summer, And one of the questions, I was on a panel, and one of the questions the panel was asked was, what do you think, what answer would you like to, what question would you like to have answered during your lifetime about consciousness? And I had to say that we don't even know the right questions now. So I think, I would just be happy to know what the right questions are. I think right now we don't even know what the real, we're just so confused about these things. And I think one way to get less confused is to build these artificial toy systems that well, we can manipulate. But, yeah, I don't know if that's relevant.
So just one last question.
Are you sure? I feel I should be generous again.
Is it going to be a...
It's very quick.
But Zdravko hasn't asked a question yet, and he...
Last question.
But you've already asked a question.
She's still suffering.
I did ask a question before.
Okay.
No, you asked a question.
Either way, it's fine with me.
It was really, again, it's a very simple one, I think, but it's the notion of depiction, and I believe that you've taken it from Igor's work, and he talks about this depiction presenting a sort of a feeling, a sense of out there.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work in these
moments? Okay, I'm glad you asked that. Right now, these are very two-dimensional, right? You just see this two-dimensional. Okay, so how about this? there are two ways that a third dimension can become involved. One isn't the way that you're interested in, but I think it's worth mentioning, so I'm going to mention it first. So suppose instead of pictures, I gave you VR goggles, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's interpreted the same way. That is, when you look around in the VR world and you get a particular, color, that means that's the input the robot expects to receive if it were to move to look in that direction. Okay. But now imagine this. Imagine you move around in this VR world. So it's a static. It's a snapshot. Now time is passing for you and you're moving in this world. But we're assuming that this is the state of the experience at some specious present for the robot. Imagine you see, for instance, a cup in the virtual world, so that means the robot expects to see white when it looks at that region. And now you move around, and you see there's no back to it. It just says undefined or gray or something like that. That would mean that this robot has no concept of a cup. And you could see that. You could say, oh, right, it doesn't understand that cups have backs, and it doesn't understand that's an object. It just sees a patch of white. So that would give you a bet. Even though you were seeing it as a cup, when you look at it here, it would quickly be revealed to you that that's not, the robot doesn't have the right expectations that a concept exerciser would have. Yeah. So that's one way to use the third dimension to give you further information about its two-dimensional aspects of experience.
Okay.
Now, how can we develop the third dimension? How can we actually understand this thing as being located a certain distance from the robot? Well, it's going to have to involve more than just moving the eyes around. Now, action by me doesn't mean probing this two-dimensional space further. What it means is, what kinds of things, so if you could reach out for it, for instance, and make, touch it in some ways or obstruct it with your hand easily like that, then that would mean one thing about distance, and if you couldn't do it, then that would mean another thing about it. And so it would be capturing the spatiality, the out-there-ness that Max talks about and Igor talks about, that are part of the content of the experience. But if it wasn't like that, if it was all just on the same surface, they're all equally distant, and you could obstruct them all with your finger, equally, then that would suggest that it doesn't have any out there. It doesn't have any notion about how the world would respond to it moving through the world. And that would mean it has a very primitive sense of space, only this two-dimensional space, not a three-dimensional space. So, yeah.
I think that's absolutely...
No more comments. Zdravko, did you want
to... We'll talk later, Susan. We'll talk later. Don't worry.
In a way, my question anticipated my question. I just wanted to ask, what sort of data do you store in order to create this expectation horizon?
Good. In this very simple model, all we do is have a lookup array. So we just store for all the possible coordinates of where the robot could move its focal point. We store the foveal. So if the robot looks at 0, 0, then at 0, 0 and a nearby neighborhood, we store the current input values, pixel values of what it's seeing right now.
So one of those circular images you saw. So it stores that. And now it has expectations for all those points. So let's say it comes back at another time, and not at 0, 0, but at 10, 10. Now it focuses on 10, 10. Well, its expectation is going to be whatever was, its expectation is going to be blue if we stored blue there previously. And now it'll also store in that circle around that area what its current input from the fovea is now.
The basically physical data.
Physical data, yeah, just pixel values.
There's no cup in it, so to say.
There's no...
No cup, the concept.
Oh, no cup, no. This is the lowest level, just patterns of, in our case, pixel values. It's not... How could you ever move it to a cup? Well, you could have... The robot could build models of pixel values. It could learn to detect patterns in pixel values. So let's say, under certain sets of pixel values, it responds with... It says, oh, that's a pattern. Let's, rather than cup, let's start with square. So it says, oh, there's a square in that array. And now it's got a neural network say that when you give it all kinds of square inputs, the same node gets activated. Square, square, square. Now it could have expectations on this level too. Not just expectations about raw inputs, but it could learn, oh, last time I looked there, I saw this thing. And so next time I looked there, I should expect to see a square. And if it's instead, it gets a pattern that doesn't, well, if it doesn't see a square, then it can have its expectations violated. So it can have expectations on the conceptual level later. But we haven't done that yet. We're just dealing with the lowest level. But it can have expectations about affect. It can say, "What if I perform that action, how will I feel?" It can have all kinds of expectations, and that can be part of the experience. What you expect, the input you expect to receive, can be part of your experience right now. So I'm in the state that is, if I were to go like this, I would expect to feel pain. I'm in the state right now that if I were to go like this, I'd expect to, all that's the comp. Right now, I'm having a experience that is all that potentiality. Anyway.
Okay, thank you.